Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hello, listeners. Lindsay Cortez here, host of the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast. Today, we have a guest who I interviewed, Dr. Efren Caballes, and we talk about different injuries, orthopedics, reds, male athletes as well, even though it's the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast. And there's a lot that we're going to get into. I'm really excited for it. Before we do, I just want to remind you, especially as one of the topics we talk about is reds, that you can head to my website, currently www.riseupnutritionrun.com, and you can take a short little quiz about, you know, some symptoms you might be experiencing of reds. You can also purchase for a small value of $9.99 our reds recovery guide if you do believe that reds is affecting you. And we also have lots of past podcast episodes shown and linked on my website to tune in and learn more to start your journey to heal and recover from reds. Take a look at the shop on our website, again, for lots of resources and recipes for a really small investment. And consider joining our Patreon, Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast on Patreon, to give a donation so that we can continue to put out this free content for you on topics such as this. And otherwise, we would greatly, greatly appreciate your donation or your membership, anywhere from just $1 to $10 a month, to help keep this podcast going. So let's get to talking about Dr. Caballes, who I chatted with, and you're going to hear in just a moment. Let me first read you his bio. He is a Chicagoland area native who attended medical school at Truro College of Osteopathic Medicine in New York City. He completed residency in physical medicine and rehabilitation at New York University Medical Center, where he also served as chief resident, which is a pretty big deal. During his residency, he was the recipient of several awards, including the Howard Rusk Award for Teaching and Leadership. Following residency, he completed an ACGME-accredited PM&R Sports Medicine Fellowship at NYU. He is double board certified in PM&R and sports medicine. And if you don't know what these terms mean, we're going to get into some of that in our conversation. And he currently practices non-surgical sports medicine at Orthopedic Centers of Colorado, Cornerstone Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. He also serves as faculty for the St. Anthony's North Sports Medicine Fellowship. His special interests and areas of expertise include diagnostic ultrasound, ultrasound-guided procedures, platelet-rich plasma, and injuries related to endurance sports. He has served as a volunteer physician at the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Training Center in Colorado Springs and helps treat high school, collegiate, professional, and Olympic endurance athletes in Boulder, Colorado. So without any further delay, let's get to our conversation, and I hope you enjoy. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Caballes, for having this conversation with me and joining me on the podcast today.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're very familiar with podcasting. You co-host your own podcast, Ready to Run. And we just want to give a shout out to that and encourage our listeners to go give it a listen as well. Can you just briefly tell us a little bit about that podcast and, you know, what your mission is there?
Yeah. So Ready to Run, it's a podcast with myself and co-host Kurt Roser, who is a physical therapist here in the Boulder area, also an elite runner, Olympic trials qualifier. And we had this initiative to start our own running podcast sometime during the pandemic as a means of getting just good information, literature, research out to the running population and kind of walking through some of the things that we see with working some with elite and non-elite athletes in the area, and also hearing from some athletes who maybe have dealt with injury and hearing their perspective so that, you know, other people who may be going through the same kind of things can hear from someone who's performing at an elite level and, you know, just kind of understand, hey, look, they're going through some of the same struggles and this is how they maybe got out of their injury and what they learned from it. So that was our main intention. And yeah, it's been great.
Yeah. What I love about it is just even just the titles of the episodes. It's like, if you have an injury, you probably have an episode about it that you can look up. Like years back, before I knew of your podcast, I had a Haglund's deformity and you did a whole episode on that. I was like, oh man, if I only had this as a resource back when I was struggling, that would have been really helpful. So for other people who are currently struggling with an injury, to head over to your podcast and you might have an episode kind of talking about that, which might help people through their injuries. And we're going to get through some of that content today, you know, how you help people through injuries. But I kind of wanted to start our conversation with just sharing with our listeners a little bit about your journey in becoming a doctor and specializing in sports medicine, working with athletes.
Yeah. I mean, overall, I'd say I probably had a fairly traditional trajectory going from undergraduate, I went to the University of Illinois and I studied molecular and cell biology. I didn't necessarily know right off the bat I wanted to go into medicine. I had some other thoughts. Actually, at one point I worked in a nutrition lab.
Oh, I didn't
know. We were looking at, some of the cardiovascular and renal effects at the time. And ultimately, just found my way to medicine. Ended up at the Touro College of Osteopathic Medicine in New York City. Mm-hmm. And there, I think, again, my initial thoughts were, I really wanted to go into either cardiology or neurology because that's what I was exposed to. But then early in my medical school career, was fortunate to have been exposed to sports medicine mm-hmm. by a couple of physicians on our faculty, and was afforded this really great opportunity as a second year medical student to work as a medical volunteer at the Elite Athletes Tent at the New York City and the Boston Marathons. And so that was pretty cool to be exposed to that. And that was my first inclination that, oh, cool, you can work with athletes for a living in medicine. So that quickly shifted my focus. And then from there, went on to our residency program at NYU, where I was a physical medicine rehabilitation was my specialty. And from there, you have a whole host of different subspecialties you can choose from. And during that time, found my way to sports medicine and ultimately did a fellowship at NYU. And that's where I learned a lot of what I use today.
Yeah. Yeah. And have you been an athlete most of your life as well? Or did, you know, kind of getting into it spark your interest too? Because you're recreational competitive athlete yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So actually growing up, absolutely not. I actually was a band nerd. I played trumpet through high school and college. And actually at one point had thoughts of majoring in music education or music performance, but that just wasn't the path that I ended up with. So, And so I think I actually got into running during residency when, there's the stress of the program and you're in the hospital all the time. I just needed some sort of outlet.
Yeah.
And so that's where I got into running. And then kind of the two things kind of were synergistic.
Yeah. And then, you know, getting that exposure at the, you know, big name marathons and probably sparked your interest a little bit too.
Yeah, it definitely did. At first, my first inclination was like, man, this is pretty crazy that somebody would run 26.2. And then I've done it 9 times since.
Right. Yeah. Amazing. Which is also really helpful. I know as, you know, being a patient myself in many situations, I always appreciate when my doctor or provider has that personal experience. You know, they don't have to be at an elite level or anything, but just knowing that they get it. They understand the importance of training for you. You know, one of the worst things I think for an athlete is when they go to a doctor and, you know, oh, my ankle hurts or whatever it might be. And the doctor's just like, oh, just, you know, take ibuprofen or rest it, which I'm not saying that's wrong. That might still be good and necessary advice, but it's, you know, it's so difficult for an athlete to hear that advice. We want to find a way that our injuries are treated so that we can get back to the sport that we love. And so when we have a provider who gets it themselves and is, you know, into a sport themselves, it really helps, I think, be on the same page with each other.
Yeah, I think there's a certain degree of empathy, especially if you've gone through it before. And I've had my own tibial stress fractures that I've dealt with myself. And I think it can be helpful.
Absolutely. So what are, as currently practicing, what are some of, and you do, just correct me if I'm wrong or feel free to elaborate, you do mostly work with endurance athletes and runners?
Yeah. So my job now, so after fellowship, I moved out to the Boulder, Denver area and joined a multi-specialty orthopedic group where I do non-surgical sports medicine. And some of the things I specialize in are using ultrasound for diagnostic and treatment purposes, but also I have this niche practice of working with endurance athletes and being in the backyard of Boulder. Again, I'm fortunate to have the opportunity to have a lot of athletes who enjoy that sport in my backyard.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. It's what they call it, like an epicenter of endurance athletes in Boulder, Colorado. So what are some of the most common injuries that you see or are treating? And again, these, as a doctor, there's a variety of injuries that you might be dealing with, you know, internal injuries, physical injuries, bone injuries, musculoskeletal, like cardiovascular, like I'm sure there's a wide variety. So what are some of the most common things that kind of always pop up in this population for you that you're treating?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of what I do is in the musculoskeletal realm. So I see a lot of like chronic tendon injuries, and that may range from like high hamstring to Achilles, patella tendon in the endurance athlete population, also rotator cuff injuries, and then also other bone and cartilage injuries, such as like hip labrum tears, knee arthritis, patellofemoral pain, some of those things. Those are some of the very common things I see on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, well, yeah, I get this like really great opportunity to work with elite and professional athletes. That's probably maybe, you know, 5 to 10% of what I actually see.
Yeah.
Most of it is like everyday people like ourselves who are just want to be active and live a healthy lifestyle.
Absolutely. And non-surgical is wonderful just because it's sometimes, you know, I think people want that quick fix and surgery is there for a reason and some people need it, but it's also so important to kind of have non-surgical treatment options because it is so invasive. And some things that you specialize in are ultrasound guided procedures and PRP. And I was just wondering if you could explain what those procedures are, kind of just give a definition first, and then maybe what type of injuries you would use it for, maybe some expected outcomes.
Yeah, no, that's definitely some great points. I mean, that's what I love about my training in physical medicine and rehab is we're kind of at the intersection of like this non-surgical and surgical realm where, you know, not everything can be treated non-surgically, not everything can be treated surgically. It's nice to have that happy medium. And so some of the tools I have to be able to do that are ultrasound. So ultrasound, a lot of times I get a lot of jokes like, hey, is that a, you know, am I having a baby? I'm like, no, well, no. It's also not the first time I heard that joke today.
Right. It's a little old. We're not laughing anymore.
But it's a great tool that's available like in the office and allows us to, you know, see different muscle tendon injuries, such as like, you know, Achilles tendon, hamstring tendon, things like that on the spot. Mm-hmm. It's dynamic. So if somebody has like a certain pain with a certain movement that, you know, if you're sitting in MRI where it might be more of a static thing, you may not be able to pick it up, but ultrasound allows you that opportunity to do things dynamically. And, you know, I've had some odd but cool cases where, you know, an example I always think of where I had an athlete with a snapping triceps in their, it was basically the triceps was snapping over the bone on their elbow and wasn't able to be picked up on the MRI. He's like, yeah, the only thing I can do is like, I can do a push-up and I can reproduce. That's the only thing I can do. So I'm like, all right, I guess I'm just going to hold my transducer here while you do a push-up and you know, pick it up that way. So that's one of the cool advantages of the ultrasound. And then it also gives us the ability to see things at a high resolution. You know, the technology's evolved even since, you know, I was first trained on it over a decade ago, where, you know, it in some settings, the resolution may be better than what an MRI can pick up. So not to say that MRIs aren't useful, it's just that you have this tool that's available that can be a great screening for certain conditions. And then that's what it can do from a diagnostic perspective. From a treatment perspective, it's great because then it allows visualization as we're performing certain procedures, such as injections, you know, targeting the tissues, and we can see that it's getting precisely where it needs to go. We can safely guide our needle so that we don't inadvertently hit other structures, and you know, it kind of takes the guesswork out of it.
Absolutely. And you reminded me, kind of pulling in a couple of our points here, when you're saying you can use it to kind of diagnose things dynamically, like as they're doing that movement, because I recently, you know, different story, but just to relate here, I was recently having some pain in my big toes as I was running, and I go to the doctor and they're moving my big toes around. Does this hurt? Does that hurt? I'm like, no. And then they do an x-ray and the technician's like, does it hurt in this position? I'm like, no, it only hurts when I'm running. And again, then the doctor's like, well, don't run. And I'm like, no, that's not my solution.
Yeah.
Or I don't want it to be, you know? And so it sounds like, yeah, that the push-up example is like, okay, well, we're going to use this tool as you're doing the thing, you know, and to help us identify or diagnose what's going on and see it more clearly.
Yeah. That's what I love about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you had asked about PRP as one of the things that I do.
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, I do know what it stands for, but for now I do. But for many, many years, like people would just say, oh, PRP, PRP. And I had no clue what they were talking about. Can you break down what it stands for and what it is?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah. So it stands for platelet-rich plasma, or PRP for short. It's basically one of our biologic injections that we use for treatment of different joint or tendon injuries. But the basic concept is that you draw someone's blood, you spin it in a centrifuge, you separate out certain products that you don't want, you keep the stuff that you want, and then you end up with a concentration of platelets that's about 4 to 8 times your normal concentration. And that helps for several different mechanisms, but I always tell people the main mechanisms, just to keep it simple, is that it can be a very powerful anti-inflammatory, and that's safer than cortisone because it doesn't have all the detrimental effects. And it can also have growth factors, which help stimulate tissue repair. So I give the analogy oftentimes of, like, think about when you get a cut, it turns all red, gets inflamed at first, platelets come to the site of injury, form a scab, and that scab breaks down, the tissue ultimately heals, returns back to normal. So it's the same kind of concept then that we can apply to tendon and joint conditions.
Well, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's definitely like an evolving science. It's probably been around since like the early 2010s. And again, it sounds great, but there's also still a lot that we know, and there's a lot that we don't know. And
still emerging.
Emerging, mm-hmm. And just a huge variability in terms of like how we want to like optimize it.
Yeah, or, you know, going back to how you said, some people might get a cortisone injection for an injury to reduce inflammation, but there might be some side effects of that, which maybe you could dig into what those side effects are. And then does PRP, do we know of any side effects that PRP might have?
Yeah. So, I mean, corticosteroids can still be quite useful in certain settings. And so I still use it in my tool bag. But the main concern is that with repetitive corticosteroid injections to certain tissues, say like somebody with knee arthritis, is that repetitive administration can have a couple effects. It can lead to, it can accelerate some of the wear and tear of the tissue, which you can see after multiple injections, or it can just kind of lose its efficacy over time as you've been exposed to it.
Yeah, then you just need more and more and more.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas like with PRP, one of the advantages is that because it's your own blood, harnesses your own body's like healing capabilities, you don't have those same negative side effects. Now, that's not to say that there are no side effects, like everything has side effects, but
yeah,
some of the main things we see are like, you know, increased pain at the injection site. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a hard time sugarcoating with my patients. So I'm, hey, this is probably going to hurt before it gets better. I'll obviously want to do things that'll make you comfortable with anesthetics and things like that, but it's something that you might actually feel a little temporary increase in pain in the short term, but in the long term can have very positive effects.
Wow. Yeah. I've never, I've heard of it. I've never seen it done. I've never had it done myself, but it does sound very, very promising. But yeah, I mean, we've only got maybe 10 years of, really doing it in practice. And so it's still evolving as science and medicine always is, but that's really something really interesting. And how much, you mentioned how PRP can really be a great anti-inflammatory. Obviously, those other things are anti-inflammatory when it comes to medicine as well. But in your practice as a sports medicine doctor, how often are you talking about the importance of nutrition as it relates to injury healing or reducing inflammation? And how much do you think that really plays a role alongside your more medical treatments that you're doing?
Yeah, it's absolutely paramount. You know, particularly when we're talking about somebody who's dealing with recurring injury is where it comes up a lot in my setting, where say for example, you have the patient who comes in with recurring hamstring pain, you've done physical therapy, you've had a PRP injection before, and it's still not getting better. And so that's where in my practice, I'll take a step back and say, okay, well, yes, there's a tendon that is a problem. or a joint that may be a problem, but, you know, what are the other factors at play? And so that, you know, for those kinds of patients, I may end up, you know, ordering lab tests to mainly start to rule some things out, mm-hmm. and kind of raise questions about the patient's training, their diet, you know, their nutrition habits, and kind of basically zoom in to see, are there any red flags here that point towards, you know, maybe there's like an energy deficiency in the background, or maybe there's a nutrition issue in the background that's not allowing that patient to heal to their optimal ability.
Absolutely. And you mentioned energy. Oh, sorry. Did I cut you off?
Oh, yeah. Sure. I was just going to add to that. Yeah. And that's where, you know, having in my practice, you know, I try to operate, you know, not in a silo, but with a team of, you know, different experts around me. So, you know, several just registered dietitians who I really, you know, lean in on for some of these things, where if I detect something, you know, I can get some labs that maybe look normal, maybe they look abnormal. There's a suspicion that fueling may be a problem. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on, you know, micronutrients or macronutrients, but yeah. I know to look for that and screen for that and send it to the appropriate person. So
Right. Yeah. And so you are in contact with dietitians and kind of refer out if needed to some of your patients.
Yeah, there's a couple of really, really great ones I work with in the area. You know, awesome. Shout out to, like, you know, Maddie Alm. She's a professional runner with Team Boss, and she has a practice called Fueling Forward, and I rely on her a lot. And then several other dietitians who can even work remotely, which is a great thing.
Right. Yeah, that's what I do. Work remotely. Yeah, it is great. Yeah, and it's just, you mentioned, you know, you're might be ruling out some nutritional things, kind of looking at this holistically as you're treating with your medicine and your treatment interventions, to still look at things holistically that might be a factor. So yeah, lab work, ruling out vitamin, mineral deficiencies, things like that. But you also just mentioned, like, underfueling. And how often do you see that somebody just, maybe this injury keeps coming up because they're just not eating enough?
Very frequently.
Right.
So part of working with endurance athletes, you know, we've talked about some pretty cool procedures and things that I do, but a big part of what I do is seeing people with bone stress injuries, you know, stress reactions, stress fractures. And, you know, I think anyone who, you know, wants to work with this population, with the running population, has to have a firm understanding on how, you know, the wide spectrum of things that can happen with a bone stress injury. You know, it's not just as simple as, oh, you know, take 4 to 6 weeks off and go back and do what you want to do. You know, sometimes actually most of the time, I would say it's probably more complex than that.
Yeah.
And I think the traditional train of thought was, you know, you see stress fracture number one, okay, maybe there's some biomechanical issues, physical therapy, things like that. And if you see stress fracture number two, then you prop this whole work up. But I think as I've started to work more and more with the endurance athlete population, one thing I've learned is, like, hey, if I see a high risk injury, like, say, like in the femur, the pelvis, sacrum, I'm not going to wait for stress fracture number two to pop up.
I agree, you know, with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and get the lab work and start asking some questions about fueling habits, and then have that patient work with our dietitian. And I think one of the common mistakes we run into is, like, you order certain labs, and some of the things I routinely order, like, you know, a complete blood count, electrolyte panels, thyroid function, iron studies, ferritin, vitamin D. Those are just kind of my basic labs. And female athletes, we might get some hormones as well, and males. But oftentimes you get this setting where someone has a stress fracture, you get the labs, you're like, okay, all the labs look quote unquote normal. All right, what do? You know, at that point, my suspicion is high that fueling, at least it at least has to be addressed.
Yeah.
Questions have to be asked.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I understand why that old way of thinking of, like, you know, wait for a second or third injury to dig deeper. But I think we have enough research in this field right now to show the importance of nutrition in bone injuries, especially in endurance athletes, to just address it right away. And I think just really highlighting how severe that is to get a bone injury from running. You know, this isn't necessarily a trauma-induced thing. And to really, we don't want to normalize, you know, we don't want to normalize bone injuries in runners and endurance athletes, because it's like, this is really severe and preventable. You know, there are some injuries that I think are, you know, aren't preventable, but this one I think is really, from a nutrition standpoint, taking care of yourself can be preventable. Not completely 100%, but so much of it could be.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, especially when we zero in on some of like the high risk stress injuries and going back to like the femoral neck, the sacrum,
such a big
deal, the pubic ramus, you know, those one, and then even the heel, calcaneus, which traditionally we thought of as like a low risk site. Well, actually, no, it's not. All the ones I mentioned are what we call like trabecular bone injuries. So when we think about, you know, bone, there's cortical bone and trabecular bone. So I always give the analogy of an M&M, right? So your cortical bone is like your thick outer layer. That's like your candy coated shell. And then, and then you have your trabecular bone, which is kind of slower to turn over and build. And that's like your chocolate insides. That's like more spongy bone. And so, you know, I think there's been a lot of research even saying that, like, when you look specifically at some of these trabecular bone injuries, such as, you know, sacrum and hip, that there's a high association with underfueling, if not even, you know, relative energy deficiency.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And oh man, I just, you know, I've been working in this field of Red S and helping athletes overcome underfueling for years now. And, you know, as I have these conversations on the podcast with people like you, and I know, you know, our listeners are just absorbing it all, I just want to be so clear to our listeners right now that just because this is the story right now, it doesn't have to be this way. Just because, oh, there's a lot of underfueling in endurance athletes and bone injuries, like, this can change. And that is my hope, that over the next 5-10 years, that this isn't the story, because this is not a good story. And I'm not trying to put, you know, the athletes who go through this, I'm not trying to put them down at all, but it's just like, let's change this, you know, let's fix this problem so that this isn't the story and the problem, quote unquote, that endurance runners face, you know, and endurance athletes face. Let's change that. Let's nourish our bodies, fuel enough, and, you know, not have to deal with this, because it's devastating when an athlete has a huge injury, and a bone injury is definitely a big one.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, yeah, having an understanding of the problem is the first step, but like working towards a solution is really kind of the thing we all want to do for our athletes. And you know, you can probably speak to this as well, but I know oftentimes, you know, again, at least in my setting, where they may be presenting for the first time, having this conversation for the first time with a bone injury, but it's opening a whole door. Sometimes that can even be a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
To say, hey, look, at the end of this appointment, okay, I'm going to get you an MRI, we're going to get some labs, I'm going to send you to my dietitian, I'm going to send you a physical therapist, and, you know, this. And it's just a lot of information at one time that just you can't possibly squeeze that into a 15 or 30 minute appointment. So having that rapport being established is something I find helpful, because, you know, I've there's numerous times where I have this conversation, and, you know, the first time around, it may not necessarily sink in. So I think our job is to at least just be there for the patient, regardless of what their response might be. Because maybe at the beginning, they for whatever reason, may not be receptive to that information. Maybe it's the first time they're hearing this, and it's totally catching them off guard. And so they're not ready to receive that information yet.
So true. And I think that people's nutrition and what they eat is a very personal thing. And then when we dig into, you know, if underfueling is a cause, the reasons why somebody might be underfueling is very personal as well, stemming from their relationship with food or how they were raised or food availability or budget and finances, you know, and the easiest one out of all of that is just maybe lack of knowledge that, oh, if we just educate you on how to eat enough, then you can start eating enough and fueling your body, and which is the case a lot of people just aren't educated on how to fuel their body for their sport or for health or nutrition. And so there's a lot of that we can solve more easily, but the other things might be a lot more personal, and a lot goes into it to make that discussion really difficult.
Totally. So, yeah. That's why, you know, on our end, or it's physician on my end, you know, simply saying, you know, stop running and eat more. That's not necessarily going to cut it.
It doesn't cut it. You have
to really understand like the motivations as to why. And I think once you really understand that and you can connect with someone on that, that's when you start to see like the real changes happening.
Now, knowing that you work with some elite runners who this is their job, their profession, and although you just said like the answer is not always stop running and eat more, because it's a lot more delicate than that. But if you know, like in your heart as the provider, that maybe is the answer for them, how do you kind of go about maybe a treatment plan for somebody who just scenario, maybe bone injury due to underfueling and a variety of other things, you know, at the elite level, is there a time and a place where you as a doctor do say you have to stop running? And is that different than how you might treat maybe more of a recreational runner or a collegiate or high school runner?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because it's obviously really delicate. And I think the first thing I do in my approach is to spread the information over multiple visits, follow-ups. Yep. Is the first thing, because again, it can be very overwhelming, especially if you're like the elite athlete who this is their job. Now, you know, the first thing to understand is like, okay, well, you know, yes, they can perform at a high level, they can do very amazing things with their bodies, but ultimately we all kind of heal very similarly. They don't necessarily heal faster. So it's, you know, I think that's the first thing to note is that, hey, you're having a very upfront conversation about expectations, about, hey, this might not be, you know, 4 week, 6 week turnaround. This might be several months. And, you know, we don't want to necessarily stop everything altogether, because that's not necessarily productive in some settings. But if there is something that they can do, and really defining, okay, well, here are the things that I would say, let's pull back on this for now. And here are the things that are okay to do, because we do want to, you know, keep that people active, because there is a mental health component again to some of these injuries and not being able to perform. So we want to be able to kind of define that right off the bat, and then kind of reassess that as we get some objective data throughout the treatment course. So that might be, you know, sticking with bone injury, getting the initial study, knowing the expectation of, well, this is how long it's going to take to heal. Like, that's just like a fact. And then here are some of the things that can either help you heal more optimally, or here are the things that might slow down your healing. And that can be different labs. That can be, you know, that can be like a DEXA scan, where if we get like a bone scan on somebody with, you know, sacral stress fracture, we find that, you know, they have a bone density of like -2.5. Well, that's going to be a very different conversation than the athlete who has that same stress fracture, but maybe has a bone density within a normal standard deviation, right?
Right.
I think that's kind of the first thing. And making sure, again, I think the biggest thing is making sure there are multiple team members involved, because like I think the biggest mistake early on I try to make is just to basically try to do everything on my own, and that's just not realistic.
No,
nor do I have the energy. So having like a really good, you know, physical therapist, a dietitian, a sports psychologist, you know, what have you, anyone I'm missing, and making sure that across the board the messaging is the same. And if there are questions that we're interacting as professionals to say, well, hey, you know, I'm not so sure what you're saying is right. Maybe, yeah, because again, the athlete, they're going to express different things to different practitioners along the way.
Right.
I might not get all the information at once, but maybe the physical therapist gets something while they're in a 45-minute visit with them, and then that helps. So I don't think necessarily the conversation changes very significantly between the elite athlete versus the non-elite athlete. I think maybe the pressures may be different to get back.
Yeah.
Just in terms of like, you know, this is their job, right? If I were out for my job for 3 months, I don't know what right. I would do. And so, right. Yeah, I think just kind of setting expectations from the get-go and having good follow-up are probably the main tenets of any athlete.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing too is just really leading any athlete with giving them the education and the knowledge of what's going on and options. And I think, you know, I think that's really been my approach as a dietitian too. It's not necessarily about like, do this because I told you to. It's more, here are your options. And as you're on this journey, you know, you might come to a certain conclusion on your own. And it's probably better that way. Like, if more rest time or downtime is going to ultimately be the answer, like the athlete coming to that decision on their own is actually usually the healthiest thing, as opposed to, you know, stopping completely before their mental health is ready for it. Or, you know, they take, okay, I stopped and I took 2 weeks off, but then I can't stand it anymore. And now I'm getting back into things too early. You know, I just think guiding their treatment plan by providing the education and working together with them on all their options is really, really helpful.
Totally. Yeah. And I think even when it comes to like rehab, exercise is something that seems fairly benign. You know, oftentimes we have an injury, we want to rehabilitate from that injury. That's how we get back. But sometimes even that can be just exhausting for an athlete who maybe this is their third time dealing with a stress injury in the past, or, you know, in the past 2 years, and they're just tired of having to do a bunch of PT. Well, yeah. You know, hey, maybe take a break.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas the first time they weren't willing to do that, but by the third time, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And maybe another question for you too, in both in your personal experience or in research that you've read and stuff, do you see any differences or common themes regarding these injuries or bone stress injuries and underfueling in a male versus a female population? Do you see it in both?
Yeah, we definitely see it in both. And I think there are some obvious signs in certain populations and some not so obvious signs. So speaking specifically to, you know, bone injuries and what may be part of what may be driving some of those recurring injuries, such as like underfueling, you know, in female athletes, you have this biomarker of menstrual cycles, which can give you an obvious sign of like good hormonal health versus when that might be compromised by underfueling. Whereas in male athletes, some of those signs might not be so obvious.
Yeah.
So there, I think too, like the research is still emerging on like, you know, things like relative energy deficiency in male athletes. There's a lot that we know, a lot that we don't know. But one of the things that we think is happening is that there's probably some underreporting in the male athlete population.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason. But there are some common signs and symptoms that you can look out for that might not be outright, or maybe you have to not be afraid to ask certain questions. So for example, in males, you know, we do see changes in reproductive health that may be driven by, you know, reduced sex drive or, you know, decreased morning erections. And so just having the willingness to ask those questions and be comfortable with that can often be helpful because you might pick up on something that can help somebody.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I think those are really equivalent questions, you know, just as we're trying over the past decade to get more comfortable asking females about their menstrual cycle and that health. And we're getting more comfortable as a society. I'm not saying we're fully there, but we are getting more comfortable instead of ignoring this or saying, oh, that's a woman's issue, you know, talk about it in private. That, you know, it's like, no, this is a medical thing. And this is important for your performance. And this is something that every woman goes through. So we should talk about it openly, about hormones, about periods. Well, we need to do the same thing for men as well, and their hormones and what they're experiencing. And, you know, I'll just, as a woman, I'm like, oh yeah, I don't feel comfortable talking about that yet. But if we're going to expect that out of our male doctors and male coaches to be comfortable talking to females about their menstrual cycles, then we need to do the same for our male athletes as well and be comfortable talking about that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just yeah, I think just data and information and all those things are just, you have to think about it in terms of, well, how can I help this person? And what information do I need to help that person?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I just think that our hormones are kind of one of the, I think maybe more obvious, both in how we act, and then you can get a blood panel and show you your hormone levels too. It's a little more obvious because there's things when it comes to underfueling and red S, it's like, oh, like depressed mood. And while that could be for a lot of reasons.
Right. It's like, yeah, is it the injury itself that you're mad about, or
right,
is the underfueling driving that?
Yeah. Yeah.
The symptoms.
Or is it family issues? Or is it, you know, there's just like a lot. Is it seasonal, you know, mood, depression, whatever. And then, yeah. And I just think that there's a lot with red S that is hard to, this is why it's hard to diagnose red S, because it's not one thing. And even what symptoms you have could be a bunch of other reasons. But that hormone panel, which again, there's other hormonal issues, but I think that is one thing that's like, oh, I'm injured, I am depressed, my performance is declining, and male or female, I'm having these hormonal issues. Oh, now we're putting those pieces of the puzzle together. And I think that is one kind of more solid data point of, oh, my menstrual cycle is missing, or, oh, I'm not getting morning erections, or, oh, on my blood work, my testosterone is low and my estrogen is really low. Like it's a little bit more clear of a data point. And so I do find that really helpful when it comes to diagnosing red S. But as I'm looking out for my listeners right now, I do also want to be clear, you can have red S even with hormones okay as well, because there are all Absolutely. Those other things too. Because I've certainly had clients who say, well, do I really have red S? Because I'm still getting my period and my hormones look fine. And I'm like, ah, but we still have all these other things. And I'm looking at your nutrition and I can tell that you're not eating enough. So you still have underfueling and you've got symptoms of red S still.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can present a lot of different ways. And, you know, the IOC just published their most recent update to their consensus statement earlier this year. And they revisited their little wheel of both physiologic and performance things. And physiologically, yeah, you can see, yes, there's reproductive function, there's bone health, there's musculoskeletal injury, there's like, you know, the upper respiratory infection that pops up the week before a marathon, or getting frequently sick. You know, those are, you know, are certain things. Feeling cold in your hands and fingers, that's, you know, underfueling can affect your like vasodilation and, you know, shunt blood to more vital organs. So it's a very common thing that somebody may say in passing, and you don't want to like blow it off. and really kind of make you kind of think critically. Also things like irritability, poor sleep, you know, those are the common things I tend to see. And you just, you just stack data with all these things for sure. And then sometimes that doesn't resonate with people too. Like talking to like adolescent athletes, like I think we start talking about like bone health, risk of osteoporosis. You know, adolescent athlete, or maybe this is an athlete who's never been injured before and hasn't really had significant time loss. You know, that might not resonate, but when you start to dig in about performance and you start to see someone's putting in the work, but not necessarily seeing the results of that work, results in to improve performance, that can also be a red flag. And when you start talking about that, that can sometimes be a clue to say, hey, maybe you need to look at your fueling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this was a really helpful conversation, and just looking at, you know, treating Red S from your perspective as a doctor and being an important role in that multidisciplinary approach towards something, because it is it's a multidisciplinary condition. So you might need a dietitian, you might need a doctor, a physical therapist, an endocrinologist. There's a lot of different specialties that might need to be addressed, and your role in that as a sports medicine doctor is huge. Thank you so much for this conversation. I think really enlightening about just different types of treatments and your role in Red S and nutrition in healing injuries as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, and before you go, I have a few fun questions to ask you. Are you ready to play?
Let's hope so.
If there's one food you could eat every single day for the rest of your life but never get sick of it, what would it be?
Fried chicken.
Chicken?
Yeah, fried chicken specifically, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I love it.
Easy. Baked chicken, fried chicken, all the chicken. Awesome. What is your favorite sport to participate in yourself?
I think for me, it's running. It's easy. Yeah. It's accessible. You know, I have two young kids, a two-year-old and a three-month-old. So, you know, my work has to get done in the morning. Otherwise, it doesn't get done. And so it's just easy to pop on the treadmill or whatever, go off for a run. And it's great. Love it.
Awesome. And how about as a spectator? Is it still running, or is there another sport that you're a big fan of and love cheering on?
I do love spectating running, especially when it's really cool when I can see some of the athletes I work with. But honestly, basketball. I've always loved basketball. I grew up in Chicago during the 90s, Michael Jordan era, and that's what I love.
Awesome. And because this is the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast, is there a female athlete out there that you want to give a shout out to for being just a role model, an inspiration for any reason? And she can be somebody well-known or just in your personal life.
Oh, boy, this is hard. There's a lot to choose from that speaks to the state of female athletes today. I would probably say I really like and look up to Gwen Jorgensen, who lives in the area. I like how she approaches things. And she was on our podcast, and I remember her talking about injuries. And one of the things that she had mentioned was sometimes you just need to let the healing come to you and don't try to force it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that really, really resonated and was a really great piece of information, at least for me to hear as a physician who takes care of athletes. Yes, we have all these really cool tools, but sometimes we just need to let things play out. And so she's someone I definitely look up to.
Yeah. And that was great advice from someone at her level. You know, some of these Olympians and professional athletes have dealt with their share of injuries that I think, you know, at her level, she's probably got a great outlook on it and how to deal with them and overcome them more efficiently. Well, thank you again, doctor, for having this conversation. Really helpful.
Well, thank you.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition, then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. We don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie, please go check them out, and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action. Head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise. Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide. Or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new Coaches Toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.